from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. An angry American shoots a Bangladeshi immigrant behind the counter of a convenience store in Texas in the days after 9/11. The immigrant survives and works his way up to a good life in America. As he climbs that ladder, he sees he has advantages in America as an immigrant from the third world that his American shooter does not have, and fights to save his would-be killer from execution. This hour on Point, a harrowing story out of Texas and what it tells us about immigration and opportunity in this country. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can you see how an immigrant born in a poor third world country might have advantages in outlook and aspiration that a native-born American might not? How should this story inform our great immigration debate? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from New York is Anand Giridharadas, columnist for The New York Times, raised by first-generation Indian-American parents outside Cleveland and beyond. His new book is The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Anand Giridharadas, welcome back to On Point.
Always such a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
There's so much depth to get into here. It is really fascinating. It speaks to just this moment. In Washington, the president and now some leading Republicans are saying we have just a little time to work on a big immigration deal. This week, we have the ceremonial opening in New York at Ground Zero of the September 11th Memorial Museum. Your story kind of ties those two together in an absolutely fascinating way. I wish you'd just take us back to the basics of this story. There's a lot to dive into here about immigration, native-born Americans, their relations. But tell us the basics of the story between these two men.
In the immediate days after 9/11, when so many of us were anguished and watching these reruns of those planes strike those towers again and again and again, a handful of us around the country went into a further craze and went what Mark Stroman, one of the two main characters of this true story, called Arab hunting. And so Mark Stroman goes to three different gas stations in and around the Dallas, Texas area, pulls up in his Thunderbird, parks it, walks into the mini mart in each of these three gas stations, and shoots the clerk behind each of these three mini-mart counters, all of them brown-skinned immigrants, two of them Muslim, none of them Arab.
I have a little video from 2001, if I may, Anand. This is the voice of Mark Stroman talking with KDFW in Dallas about why he went on this killing rampage.
It was like I had no control of my body. I acted on instinct. I did what I thought I had to do. I did what every other American wanted to do, but didn't have the nerve.
Didn't have the nerve. At the Buckner Mini Mart, he pulled out the gun, he shot, he intended to kill, he didn't. Who was behind that counter, Anand?
So two people died in that spree, but at the Buckner Food Mart, as you say, there was a Bangladeshi immigrant named Raisuddin Buyan, who goes by Race, mm-hmm. and that day, for some reason, Mark Stroman used a different gun and sprayed a bird shot into the face of Race Buyan instead of a conventional bullet, filled his face with 39 pellets, two of them perforating his eye, almost touching his brain. Those 39 pellets would remain in his face the rest of his life, but did not kill him. And that day, as Raisuddin Buyan was laying on the floor of the convenience store thinking he was dying, he looked up to the sky as a religious man might, and frankly, as a secular person might, and said to his God, "God, if you save me today, I will dedicate the rest of my life to serving others." But it took him a very long time to figure out, to reach an epiphany of how he could serve others in an astonishing way.
He was not Arab. He was Muslim, and he did make good on that promise. He survived that shooting. Stroman went to prison, eventually to death row, and while he was there, his case was taken up by none other than Raisuddin Buyan.
It must be, you know, last night we had this case in Texas of a man pleading, his lawyers pleading on his behalf to save his life right before execution, and that is common. People obviously plead for their own lives. What happened in this story was was bizarre and astonishing and wondrous. It was the victim, Reis Bouyan, who in those same final months, weeks, days, then even hours, the final hour itself, was sitting on a witness stand in a court in Texas, arguing that his constitutional rights were being violated, his freedom of religion, because as a Muslim, he had a right to unilaterally exonerate someone who had harmed him, and that that would deprive the state of Texas from the right and the opportunity to execute that person.
He sued the governor of Texas, Rick Perry. He did everything in his power as an immigrant to help the man who had shot him. We have just a little bit of Reis Bouyan's voice. Here it is from a 2011 interview. He talked with Texas news station KVUE about what he would say to his one-time would-be killer, Mark Stroman, if he were to meet him.
I'll look at him in the eye and I'll tell him that you are another human being like me. And I never felt angry at you. I don't hate you. You are just another human being like me. Happened to be, you did a terrible thing out of your anger, out of your ignorance, but I don't hate you.
He was not able to save him, but he learned a lot about him. What did this immigrant learn about the American who killed him, Anand? Who tried to kill
him? I think in many immigrant stories, I would say to some degree in my own family's immigrant story, what happens is people come from the so-called third world, and by dint of their education and their pluck and the kind of energy level they bring as an outsider, they are able to access a first world America that still works very well. And if it works well for them, what often happens is they become somewhat blind or never even see to begin with a third world America that actually is very much here. And that might have been Reis's story, but because he was shot, he was forced to confront questions about who was that man. That becomes, if you would understand, the central question of your life. Who was that man? What circumstances allowed this to happen to me? Was this a fluke? Was this a one-off guy? Or did he represent something that I need to be on guard for more generally? And as over 10 years, Reis sought to answer those questions, as he got to understand Mark Stroman's background through sitting at the trial, as he got to work with working-class Americans at the Olive Garden, as he got back on his feet, through all these things he realized, as many immigrants do not, that there is a hurting country right beside the successful one they have accessed. And he started to make it his cause to do something not just about Mark Stroman, but about that hurting America. So forgiveness, fighting for his life, was the beginning of an outreach to that hurting America.
There's a reversal.
But it went on.
We'll look at how it went on. There's a reversal of cliche here in a way. I mean, it's the immigrant feeling sorry for the sort of rough and ready native-born American.
It is, and that's why I thought it was such a powerful story to tell, particularly with the immigration debate that you mentioned. Part of the extraordinary business model of America, to kind of put it that way, is that America is all about, more than any other country in the world, taking new blood and merging it into an existing bloodstream. But it's not just new blood that makes America great. It's the new blood coming into this very good bloodstream. If the new blood on its own was so successful, India and Nigeria and other places like that would be the most successful countries in the world. It's the merger of people like my parents, like Reis, into this extraordinary system, the system that has been held onto by people who got here before. And what happened in this story was a guy who was able, though coming from one of the poorest countries in the world, to plug himself into this extraordinary system and build an extraordinary life even after being shot in the face.
Did he reach Mark Stroman in Mark Stroman's soul? Did Stroman understand that someone was forgiving, reaching out to him? Did it change his view of the world, Stroman's?
It did reach him, and he called it the first act of kindness he'd ever known. But it's important to note that it wasn't the beginning of his transformation. It was sort of the culmination of his transformation. Mark Stroman changed hugely over 10 years in the same way that Reis evolved over 10 years. And he, when he got to death row, basically everybody he knew from his past, the people who had helped to form him and kind of ill-form him, you could say, all fell out of his life. Very few came to visit him. Very few were in touch, including his own family. All the new people who came into his life were very good people, educated people, people who were religious ministers to him, an Israeli documentary filmmaker who became a friend and kind of a mentor to him and others. And it's amazing that a 30-something-year-old man who, as you heard on that clip, sounds just like a bone-rotten murderer, and maybe just a bone-rotten murderer, also is able to evolve, even at that pretty late stage in life, once you take all the bad influences away and plug new influences in.
Yeah, it's amazing that what? I mean, I don't know if he sounded like a bone-rotten murderer. He certainly did murder, and he tried to. He also came to a realization, ultimately in prison, of some of the pain he had caused. And we have a little tape here. This is July 18th, 2011, from CBS. This is 2 days before Mark Stroman's execution. Here's Stroman.
My split second of hate and anger after 9/11 has caused many people lifetimes of pain, and I regret that to this day.
The execution went forward, and there is a remarkable story in it. Anand Giridharadas, we're so glad you're with us. The new book is The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas, a loaded title, freighted. We'll look at that and much more. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the immigrant view of America, the American view of immigrants, in a tale of blood and forgiveness out of Texas. Anand Giridharadas tells the whole story in his new book. It's called The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Mark Stroman eventually executed for murders. He did not end up killing Reyes Buyan, who came to his defense, who forgave and tried to save his life. Here's Stroman. This is before his execution, talking with Dallas CBS 11 in July 2011 about Reyes Buyan's efforts to stop his execution.
There is a lesson of forgiveness, you know, for him to step forward after I tried to take his life. He's trying to save my life. That speaks volume.
That speaks volumes. I tried to take his life. He tried to save my life. Anand, what was Reyes's background? I mean, he didn't come out of nowhere. He came from a pretty stable family in Bangladesh. He was in the Bangladeshi military before he came to New York and ended up working behind the counter in a mini-mart.
He was, and he, you know, I think so many of us descend from immigrants in this country, and many of us descend from immigrants who were fleeing something, who really didn't have a lot of a choice. Religious persecution or bad circumstances of other kinds. But a lot of us descend from people who were fleeing perfectly decent circumstances, but had this kind of gnawing feeling that we needed more. Something more eluded them. And those were the people who often left their brothers and sisters and were the ones in their family to come to the new world. And he is one of those. He, upper middle class family in Dhaka in Bangladesh, a prosperous family in a poor country. He got into the Air Force Academy in his country, was then commissioned as an Air Force officer in his country, the highest of the high in that country. He would have been chauffeured around for the rest of his life. He would have probably been on fancy UN peacekeeping missions around the world. But something in him wanted more. And he decided that America was that more and set his goal on working in IT in America. So comes to New York for a couple of years, works in gas stations, works as a waiter in a French restaurant, bounces around. And then a classmate, a schoolmate from Dallas, who lives in Dallas now but back from his Bangladeshi days, calls him and says, you got to come visit me in Texas. I own a bunch of gas stations and other businesses, and you can own one too. Before long, come visit me. And Race goes to visit him and finds that the bathrooms in Texas are as big as the bedrooms in New York. And says, you know what, this seems like a good place to go. Texas is kind of the opposite of Bangladesh. If you're going to leave, leave the full way.
Go big, go all the way. It was kind of a rough exurb of Dallas. It was not economically advantaged, to say the least. The customers who came to his mini-mart, a lot of them were not in good shape economically. How did he come to see the people he was working with, the people around him? How did he come to understand the upbringing and life of his eventual assailant, Mark Stroman?
The first thing that struck him, and you have to remember, this is someone coming from a country that in the world's mind is only associated with poverty. But he landed in America. He's working in Texas in this convenience store. And he is flabbergasted by the very different kind of poverty that's around him. And he has imagined America to be this kind of country where the streets are paved with gold.
Top to bottom, yeah.
And he's in this place where there's poverty and lack of resources that are similar to what he knew back home. But there's this further poverty of connections. That back home where he came from, if you didn't have money, you at least had people. You had a big family, you had a clan, you had people who took care of you, people who'd feed you when you were sick. And he was in this country where people didn't seem to have much by way of money, but also didn't seem to have much by way of people. And he noticed that first in the convenience store, and then a few years later, having been shot, having lost his sight in his right eye, having tried to recover, he gets a job at the Olive Garden, first real job that allows him to get on his feet. And everybody else, most of the other people working with him, are native-born Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks to them, starts to learn about their lives. And it's kind of his first real exposure to working-class Americans over a sustained period. And he's astonished because none of them have human connection in their lives. Almost all of them complained of various forms of abuse and neglect and drugs in their parents' raising of them. Now many of them wrestled with that themselves. None of them could kind of lease a car because they had no one in their lives willing to co-sign a lease for them. Many of them walked home in 110-degree heat, including young women, in the summer on the highway's edge because they had no one in their lives to give them a ride. And, of course, sociologists, as you know, from Bob Putnam on the left to Charles Murray on the right, have been writing about this for years, this kind of withering of social fabric,
American
social capital.
Isolation.
But this is a guy who didn't know any of those debates and is just here on the ground trying to figure out why he was attacked over years and experiences this fraying fabric firsthand and starts to understand that Mark Stroman wasn't a fluke. Mark Stroman grew out of a failing society right next to the thriving society he was living in.
Tell us something about Stroman and his individual life and his outlook. I mean, he went in and the only question he asked on the day that he pulled out the gun was, where are you from? Without even, and then he fired. Who was he?
Mark Stroman was in some ways an embodiment, grew out of this white working class that we've kind of been talking about for the last few years as kind of suffering and not making it up to the level of the previous generation, grew out of a kind of hard community where families tend to be breaking down and meth has done an enormous amount of damage, et cetera, et cetera. But from a very early age, Mark Stroman clearly had problems that were wholly his own, from, you know, nightmares of alligators under his beds and monsters in the ceiling that kind of went beyond normal childhood nightmares, and siblings would find him kind of outside in the backyard at night sleepwalking, and it kind of escalated to beating kids up and minor run-ins with the police in his kind of preteen and teen years, to stealing a pickup truck, to slowly escalating crimes that were minor robberies, major robberies, brief stints in prison, and started to live this life where every few months or maybe even for a year or two, he would try to pull things together and marry someone and have a child and commit to sticking around. And then he'd kind of go wild again and would be, you know, make that classic male error of dating the strippers instead of just watching them strip and going out to all hours of the night and getting into a fight with anybody willing to fight him. And there was just clearly this boyish, undeveloped boyishness in him in the body of a massive man. And he is not alone in that. One of the things that really, really struck me in the reporting of this story is anytime I found a name of someone he knew and played with in childhood, and one of the other boys, because that boy was, say, in the other pickup truck with him that he stole, if I ran that boy's name and date of birth through the internet today, chances are that boy was in jail for violent crimes also. So you have an entire social world, much like the world depicted on Breaking Bad and any of these other shows, where a great number of men have completely collapsed and completely abdicated almost all of the responsibilities of civilization and are passing through bad schools, a kind of incarceration system, failing families, And as the psychiatrist at Stroman's trial said, we don't know what to do with them as a state, as a society. So we just wait for them to kill someone, and then we kill them.
Anand, I find the story gripping. I can imagine all kinds of ambivalence in how people hear it and receive it. I mean, how do you look at it? Is this, in the end, a kind of kumbaya story, let's all get along, understand each other's circumstances? Or is this, could this be heard as a immigrant, you know, look down your nose at me story, at us story, get out of here?
I think the only way to read this, as far as I can tell, is as an all-of-the-above story. I think it becomes dangerous to pick out any one of these elements. It's very easy to say, well, if immigrants can do it, why can't native-borns do it? That's not the logic of this story. That may be one logic of this story. But part of what race understood was that actually people who are born here often don't have the chance he did as a late arrival. So what I'm trying to do here is scramble everything you think about everything. And, you know, one of the things that I really take away is that America is actually different from a lot of countries grappling with decline in the West, whether it's France or Spain. America's still a big part of America. I would dare to say the part of America you and I live in right now. Your radio station, my newspaper, my publishing company, the neighborhood I live in are actually part of an America that is not only doing fine, but that is actually still doing better than it has ever done or than any other place in the world has ever done. And it's not a 1% America. It's a 30% America. A pretty big chunk of this country is amazingly successful and thriving. But there's a kind of 70% of this country that stopped working a long time ago. And it's the America kind of between the points on the Amtrak that we whiz by, that is hollowed out and rotting and suffering from an economic crisis, a crisis of the family, crises of drugs. And the good news, I wouldn't know what to do if this was France. The good news is we have this world-class top, these amazing institutions that do the best work in the world in every field. If we can just connect them to our 70%, if the people in that functional world can find an interest in Kentucky as much as they do in Africa, I think we'll be able to get somewhere.
And yet, there can be plenty of discomfort in your story where with an immigrant, a very well-meaning and ultimately successful immigrant, in his actions, calling this country out on that America that we all know is up against it. It is not in the labor force anymore, that's really struggling here. And of course, all of this flows into the emotions of our unending immigration debate about who's going to cost whom what here, about what's at stake. Is a little of the flavor of that. This is Michelle Bachmann at a Tea Party rally last June in Washington talking about immigration.
Amnesty costs a fortune. Amnesty could also cost something more than just money. It could cost a nation.
Amnesty could cost a nation. Let those immigrants settle in and it could cost a nation. A very prominent battle cry in the whole immigration battle. Anand Giridharadas is with us. His new book is The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. He joins us today from New York. Anand calls for you, if I may go to them. Let's go to the Bronx, not so far from you. Vishal is calling. Vishal, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to posit perhaps an alternative story or perhaps ask Anand if in fact, this Bangladeshi gentleman was perhaps the exception. I increasingly see, I come from a South Asian immigrant family, I increasingly see successful South Asians, or Asians in particular, in fact, retreating to conservative American ideals and almost viewing this gentleman who committed this heinous crime mm-hmm. as the other, as the, for lack of a better term at the moment, untouchable, if you will.
Untouchable as in the South Asian outcast sense.
Sure. Exactly.
Low caste, low.
That way. Mm-hmm. And it's not just limited to South Asians. I mean, I think the Koreans experienced a similar problem with the black community in the post-Rodney King riots. And I think that if you look at the political spectrum, you see Bobby Jindal or Nikki Haley as representative of some of those swings to the conservative with no real concept or empathy for the heartland of America.
Hey, Vishal, I'm so glad you called with that view. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Vishal, stick with us. Anand, what about it? Here, your guy, race, went to Mecca. and in a sort of a, what, paroxysm of religious commitment, said, I'm going to try and help the man who tried to hurt me. But Vishal says, not everybody does. You can go the other way. There's plenty of tradition in South Asia, Bangladesh included, for going the other way toward a kind of a really severe rejection of the lowest in society.
I think Vishal is exactly right. And I think it is exceptional. And that's one of the reasons. I mean, I said at the beginning, I think if race hadn't been shot, he might have been like all the immigrants Vishal talked about. And that's what I was referring to, that part of what happens when you're when you come here and you're kind of a self-maker in your own self-conception, you invent yourself and you brave the odds, and everybody has their, you know, I came here with $7 or $100 or $30. Everybody has their dollar story. It feeds an idea that I didn't need any help. So all these people lying around here, they should get up off their butt and do something. And I think that's a very limited story. And I wanted to tell this story because race, through being shot and being forced to confront the American undernation, was able to come to a much deeper understanding that the people around him who were failing didn't choose failure. They were born into circumstances. Sure, they made a lot of bad choices, but it was a story, as race came to understand it, of the devastating interaction of few choices and bad choices.
What about, you hear Michelle Bachmann in the tape we just played, and Vishal, thank you very much for your call from the Bronx, but Michelle Bachmann, her assertion is it goes the other way, that if we let these people in, it's going to cost us. It's going to cost us big time. They'll be a burden, a load, and they will change in a terrible way the nature of this country.
You know, I think one of the things that we have to acknowledge is that, of course, immigrants change a country. And people like Michelle Bachmann may not want to change America, and I guess that's a reasonable view. But starting to close America off to that change would actually be a profound change, because for all of American history, America has welcomed all kinds of people. And part of the extraordinary model of this country is this recurring passage of the country into new hands. And this is what makes America a lot more stirring to people than almost anywhere else, because the commitment of this country is not to hand it down to the genetic descendants of the people who are currently here. It's kind of like this open source idea of a country. And most of us, I think, understand that it doesn't matter the blood type or genetic composition of the people who will inherit this country 500 years from now. We would be much more concerned about the ideas and values they would hold. And we're willing to have it be different people than us, most of us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the immigrant view of America, the American view of immigrants. Of course, there are many on both sides of that equation, all pulled together in a tale of blood and forgiveness out of Texas. Anand Giridharadas has written it, the story of a man who walked into a mini-mart outside Dallas 10 days after 9/11, shot the Bangladeshi Muslim immigrant man behind the counter there. He did not die, went on to forgive the native-born American who shot him, even tried to save him unsuccessfully, ultimately, from execution in Texas. But it's quite a story of people from very different parts of the world coming to see one another. The book is The True American Murder and Mercy in Texas. There's an excerpt at our website. It's a very provocative title, Anand, The True American. What do you mean by it?
It was a phrase actually used by Mark Stroman to sign many of his letters and then eventually the blog posts he kind of submitted by letter from prison. And he called himself the true American, and his conception of it is a narrow one. Part of what I wanted to do was problematize that phrase, the true American. It's funny, even if you look on Twitter, independent of this story, and you look at the hashtag true American, it's a kind of pretty narrow conception, and thanks to a television show, also a drinking game. And part of what I wanted to do with the book is actually open up the question of what a true American is. And we've actually been playing around on Twitter with asking people, what do you think, hashtag true American is? And what are the other things it is besides a kind of loud, proud Texas patriot. And amazing responses have been coming in. People are saying a true American, you know, always chooses credit over debit. A true American, you know, is a family person. A true American leaves the country better than he found it. There's a range of things here. And of course, in this story, many people will come away from the story feeling that race bouillon represents at least as much, if not more, of certain ideals inherent in what we think of as a true American, as the self-proclaimed true American who shot him.
I should say we've collected a bunch of those tweets at our website, onpointradio.org. You should check them out. Anna, let me problematize that a little bit further. Whatever American means, there's also a long-standing strand that in the understanding of it that is not only about wealth and success. That may even be about rejecting that, about obstreperousness, you know, about boisterous independence, about not being judged just by, we all know the classic immigrant story of come and succeed and, you know, even build a fortune, become a baron. But there's another American story in which that's not necessarily the top goal. It's about life and independence and don't tread on me.
Absolutely. And I again, you know, in this story, people are unlikely to feel equally benevolent towards race bouillon and Mark Stroman. But I would actually urge people to go behind them to the ideas and the claims that each represents. And I think the ideas and the claims are actually each of merit and of value. And I actually think they both make America work. And I would say race embodies the tradition you described, which is, I would say, fundamentally a tradition centered on the idea of a strong self who, independent of context and circumstance, kind of makes their own fate. And that's a big part of our narrative. It's not necessarily the full reality, but it's a big part of our narrative. But there is, as you say, another tradition of thinking, which is really about the community, about keeping things as they are, about holding on to a culture, and more than that, about an understanding that self-making does not a great country make. That if everybody is just a striver, a solo striver, you don't necessarily develop a society. You just have an economy. And I actually think both of these ideals of, in some ways, community and of this kind of rugged individualist striving are what make America, the ballet between them is kind of what makes America work.
Anand Giridharadas' book is The True American, Murder and Mercy in Texas. We've got callers from all over this country. Let's go to them. Anne in Charleston, South Carolina. Anne, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I came to this country from Hungary. I grew up in Budapest and came in my late teens with my family and landed in Nikki Haley country in South Carolina. And people were gracious and loving and reached out to us and assisted us and helped us to get on our feet because we had nothing. But the point I want to make is this. We were Europeans, white people, if you will. Educated, but I remember the South and America where the blacks or African Americans were second or third class citizens. But because we came from Europe right off the bat, we were accepted and assisted and cared for until we got on our feet. And If we were not seeking a great deal of money, we came from a totalitarian communist country, escaped, and literally walked across a minefield to get into Austria, and we were seeking political freedom and the freedom to be.
And I'm glad you raised this. I'm glad you specifically raised this issue of race, skin color here. And here you are settled with your wonderful Hungarian Southern accent out of Charleston. I just love it, Anne. Let me take it, Anand, if I may, the complication of color in this story. Anne tells a time of immigration where, you know, she was European coming to America and she just felt a welcome mat.
Absolutely. And I also love that Hungarian Carolinian accent.
Yes.
How many countries produce things like that?
Super.
And she's absolutely right that color is a very important factor here, although I would argue part of the story of America that I'm trying to tell here is that color used to be much more of a dividing line than it is. Class is becoming so much more salient in some ways because of the failure of a lot of people in the white working class whose outcomes are now quite similar to what we've been talking about with kind of the inner city for years. But she's absolutely right that an immigrant from Europe coming into that environment would, in some ways, as race did, be able to kind of jump over a lot of deep racial history. And the temptation in that situation is always to extrapolate from your story to theirs, to look at people who are left behind and say, well, I guess they didn't try as hard as me. I guess they didn't have my mind-dodging skills. But the reality is those people have a history that the immigrant has only begun to understand and have traumas and have kind of inherited an inherited catastrophe in many cases that are completely new to the outsider. And again, things that we can do both as immigrants and native-borns to try to understand that other third, two-thirds of America are very powerful.
The face of immigration has changed. An anti-immigration rally can so easily edge toward a race rally these days. There's much more to it even than that. Soji in New Orleans. Soji, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm an immigrant from Nigeria. I have an engineering degree from LSU.
Great.
And I just really wanted to say that everyone that looks at often the poor communities like African-Americans and say to them they should get up and do this. The fact is that none of us, even you and your speaker, that none of us would be here if we weren't on the shoulders of some giant, of somebody that's helped us. Those kids don't have that. I mean, I wake up and I'm driving to work in the morning, and I see some of the men in New Orleans, they like the African-American men, which is really sad to me because I tutor some of those kids. They sit on the sidewalk in the morning and they start drinking. And I'm thinking to myself, those kids, they're off to school, yes, but they come back to that every time? And it just made me want to just...
Soji, you're from Nigeria. When you see that, do you see an individual failing, a social failing? What do you see?
I see both. What I see is that the parents have failed, and thus... the society, it becomes a society's burden to take care of those kids. Isn't it by chance they were born into such a situation? Isn't it by chance I was born into my situation? Even Emma Lazarus, the quote she made about Lady Liberty, she says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. I lift up my lamp beside the golden door. Well, those poor and those marsh, they are not immigrants anymore. Those masses, those poor, those neglected folks, they're right next door. And that's the sad thing. A lot of the politicians, they ignore that. They say, oh, get up. Kids, they're kids.
Soji, Nigerian American, you were tuned right in here, and I so appreciate that observation. The witness you share with us right there. Let me hold that, if I may, Soji. I appreciate your call from New Orleans. Get one from Nashville. Carl, you're on the air.
You know, two things I've taken from today's show. Number one is people from Texas calling themselves true Americans or real Americans, and the irony in that is that they're always talking about seceding from the Union. That I find that very ironic, and I find it hilarious that they don't even get that, the irony in that. Number two, something you all kind of glossed over, and Tom, I would never tell you how to produce your show and what to put on your show.
Come on,
but Carl. It could be a two-hour show. It could be a two-hour show within itself, and that's the deception that have been almost hypnotizing on the American public of this American individual ruggedness that you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And if you attempt to help someone or help that woman that's walking home at night, or if you attempt to pull that man up out of the gutter and help them, you're called a socialist and a communist. And I think that that's something that we have to get out of our psyche in America, that we do not help one another. We have been taught, especially since the 70s and 80s, to not help our uncle, our brother, our sister, that's maybe hooked on drugs or something like that, because we've been taught since then that they are criminals. They have criminalized a disease that's drug addiction in this country, and we have been taught that we can't help these people. We must ostracize them and push them out of society instead of holding them in our arms as we should as human beings.
Carl, we got it, and I appreciate your call and your guidance there. Thank you very much from Nashville. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. All right, Anand, there's two great calls. Let me bring to you the piece from Carl right there. He calls the story of individual ruggedness pulling up by bootstraps a deception. And, of course, it can be hard. And when society kind of falls apart, you don't have those supports around you, it can be very difficult. On the other hand, I'm reading in your book, and your Bangladeshi immigrant looks at the men who tried to kill him and others of his economic tier. And he's thinking, as the immigrant who doesn't have a whole lot in this country, hey, native-born American, he's also thinking, why aren't you taking advantage of the opportunities around you? In spite of all the headwinds and all the difficulties, I'm the immigrant, I'm working at the mini-mart, I'm trying to get my life together. He's thinking, why aren't you, native-born American, doing the same thing?
You know, I think both callers raised such good points. You may have the only show where your callers are better than your guests, but, you know,
it's all hard. It's all good.
Carl's point is exactly right, and you know, but I would say that I think part of what makes this country work in the way it does is actually being able to hold those two ideas in tension: the idea of lone wolves and the idea of it takes a village. And I actually think we're a country that's at our best deeply committed to both, not at our worst. And there are places that only do in a way what Carl said. And I would think of, you know, Norway, which I spent some time in not long ago. Mm. Norway is very committed to the idea of cushioning and comforting. But the reality is Norway has not achieved and will never achieve any of the things America has. And maybe some people prefer that. But I kind of like to live, I think as many of us do, in a country that's kind of greater than just being comfortable. And I think part of the difficulty here, part of the difficulty that I think race has struggled with as he's gone through this, is realizing that it's partly the competitive ruthlessness of this country that gets the best out of people. And if we do right, balancing that with a care for each other, balancing the story of rugged individualism with a story of it takes a village. And when we get it wrong and we err either side, we go the wrong way.
But watch out for that balance. I mean, you leave out too big a swath and you may have trouble. Our time grows short, but I want to get another one or two here. Wyeth is calling. Hi, Wyeth. Thank you very much. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a college English teacher. Mm-hmm. I've been teaching high school and college English for 28 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm enjoying your show. I was struck by the factor of the mention of community.
Yes.
I encounter both groups that are your topic today in the writing center at the college where I teach, particularly students of immigrant families who are good students but struggle with writing.
Yep.
As well as, over the years, many students from disadvantaged already American populations.
Mm-hmm.
And you are you're right on target today. It's community that makes the difference. Even a community of faith, you know, that mm-hmm. bolsters, or even volunteer organization that bolsters the arriving immigrants, helps them sort of reach for that American dream, you know, just does little things, school supplies, medical care for those few months, low-cost housing. And I often think how sad it is and ironic that some of my, you know, fourth-generation Southern students of color in particular don't have that support.
Wyeth, I appreciate that firsthand testimony again there. Great witness we're hearing here today. Thank you so much for that. Anand, our time is short, but community comes out as a very important element in your story. Our immigrant had it, even halfway around the world from his individual family. The native-born American who shot him really did not. Here you are, you're second generation now. Many of us are not much further than that. How do you look at that issue of community in this country?
You know, I would say that if I look at my family's story, it's really a story of leaving an intensely communal society. And my parents, despite the bounty of that, chose to pursue a different bounty of really the right to kind of be freer and to do what you want without meddling and to not have 1,000 people asking you, you know, what you're going to get at the grocery store and what profession you're going to do. And they have managed to exploit that. But the reality is, if you don't have resources in this country and that individualism opportunity isn't really yours, and you also don't have that old world community to fall back on, you are alone in a way that you're not even alone in the poorest places in the world.
I think we've got our finger right on a core issue for this country there in the immigration debate and well beyond. Anand Giridharadas takes us there, helps us see it in a brand new light in his book, The True American: Murder and Mercy in Texas. Anand, it's always great to have you. Thank you for all your work on this story. Thanks for being with us today, Anand.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, thanks as always for all of your insights and calls. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.